Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way, so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code ACAST to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Dr. Jan Eppingstall, a counsellor in Australia who specialises in working with people who hoard. She also has a PhD in hoarding. So she is the perfect person to invite onto the podcast and pick her brains. Jan, how are you?
Excellent, thank you. And I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much. This is episode 99.
Wow.
I know.
My God.
I know. It's wild. So today we are looking at why people who hoard, hoard in the sense of why is it stuff that people end up fixating on when it could be any number of things. So it's pretty clear that if you look at people who hoard, there is often a vast amount of trauma and loss in their lives. And so on the one hand, I think, of course we hoard when I hear people's stories, but I've always been fascinated by why we hoard as opposed to something else. Why do we hoard rather than drink or drive too fast or become bullies? So that's what we are looking at today. So, Jan, what is it about stuff that makes it the addiction of choice for people who hoard?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've asked myself this and hope to find the answer through my research. And like so much in psychology and human nature, the answer is complicated. It's just complicated. But I do think that because our stuff defines us to some extent, we tend to display evidence of our personalities through it, like books, denote intelligence or perhaps open-mindedness or creativity, for example. And some people, you know, the trophies and ribbons from past triumphs when we were kids kind of shows that we're good at something at some point. But the ambivalence, we've talked about this before, about the ambivalent sense of self seen in hoarding and the inability to kind of be decisive about who we are and therefore what we own, and it feeds into this. So people who know who they are can quickly identify if they're the type of person to wear flashy clothes or ostentatious eyewear or whatever. They kind of go, this is me. I know that that's what I want to wear, or that's what, how I want to be perceived. But if you're not clear on who you are and haven't done that work to find out, you kind of are likely to want the stuff, so you can be a different person until you feel kind of like one clicks into place. I was recently talking to a client about this, about the true self, you know, their true self, and it raised this exact point. They were describing being a different version of themselves with almost everyone in their life. So every single relationship was kind of this, you know, she was a different person.
Yeah.
No one knew their true self because, you know, they were worried, oh, I might disappoint. I might be a disappointment to someone. I might not live up to the person's expectations. So feeling that need to compartmentalize relationships without allowing them to kind of mingle led this sort of sense of ambivalent sense of self. But for me as a therapist, the key to why stuff is the source or the center of someone's addiction, it's the function of those, of saving and acquiring the items. Why do we do that? What do we use them for? So common themes include things like avoiding feelings of guilt, remorse or shame, feeling incomplete or unsafe, perhaps demonstrating one's ability to follow the rules, the shoulds, the musts in our lives. So keeping things that, well, I should have that, so therefore I can't throw it out. Another one which I find reasonably often with the older generation is the reminder of the golden years when we last felt happy and alive, wanting to keep that concept of ourselves tends to be physical objects. Even as evidence of the pain and hurt we've once suffered, even want to keep reference to that because it gives us a sense, well, I've come through that.
Yeah, it validates
it. I don't know. Validates that it happened, right? Exactly. But alcohol and drugs kind of dull the pain and they're an escape for a short time. You know, gambling gives a person a chance to dream of that freedom if they won the money, and then a dopamine hit when they win. But to come back to that question of why stuff is the addiction of choice for people who hoard, I think there's a couple of things that are factors that are relevant. So first, it's the instinctual nature of hoarding, stockpiling, you know, for times of scarcity. It's in our DNA. We're animals after all. So when we feel stressed or uncertain about what the future holds, we prepare for the worst. So it's kind of logical that we would do that. And secondly, it's that kind of inability to avoid engaging with stuff. It's like food. We need it to survive. So we're unable to kind of avoid coming in contact with it, with those temptations. You know, they're put under our nose constantly by the capitalist machine. So it takes a lot of effort to, you know, to hold back on those temptations. And sometimes and often we just give into it. So I think those are kind of a couple of the things that we can't really avoid about stuff. And I do really feel like in 2023, a lot of people have a lot of stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel like COVID and that initial stockpiling at the start will have stuck around for some people.
Told you so, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
See, I said that was going to happen. And also I think even if you go to the supermarket now, even though we're not in any lockdowns, and you see that there's empty shelves, it is very anxiety provoking because it is. Hang on, maybe it's happening again. Maybe there's something, maybe I won't be able to get it. Is there something I don't know? You know, or should I just, I'll just get a few extra things just in case.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it really has made a, you know, had a big impact on people and their, you know, their sense of security around having that extra.
There just seemed to be some evidence of people inheriting hoarding. If a parent hoards, the child may grow up to hoard too. Do we know much about whether this is thought to be a learned thing or more of a genetic phenomenon? I feel like the answer to that helps us to answer why stuff a bit as well.
Yeah, I think it does. Like, the evidence does suggest that hoarding is more common amongst first-degree relatives of people who hoard compared with non-hoarding controls. So that means, you know, parents or siblings, half-siblings of you, if you have hoarding in the family. And it suggests that genetic factors account for about 50% of the phenotypic variance in hoarding. So that kind of means, yeah, you've got a 50% chance if you've got a family member who hoards. There have been some gene-finding studies that have tentatively implicated particular regions on certain chromosomes. So like chromosomes 4, 5, 6, 14, 17, and 19. But at this stage, none of them have kind of been clearly implicated as susceptibility genes. And really with mental illness, we have never found a single, you know, a single gene that we can kind of attach onto and think, well, this is the gene that is creating this situation.
Yeah.
The other thing is there's also limitations to the studies that have been done around genetic predisposition because the subjects used were diagnosed with OCD or Tourette's rather than hoarding. And as well, you know, kind of like that was a OCD and Tourette's were primary and then hoarding was secondary. And they've also not replicated these findings. So there's been very little, you know, continued support for that genetic predisposition. Yeah, I do think the short answer is no evidence of clear genetic link. But that first degree relative, that is parent, sibling, half sibling having hoarding tendency, then, you know, you're more likely to suffer yourself. Initially, there was kind of hypotheses about hoarding that it came from a life of scarcity or deprivation. That was kind of the theme that that the researchers had initially. And it was not found to be a factor, but since then we've kind of begun to understand that epigenetic and transgenerational trauma exists. So where previous generations have suffered significant unspeakable trauma, such as Jews in World War I or any First Nations peoples across the globe, this can impact the expression of genes in subsequent generations. So the genes don't necessarily change as such, or there isn't one particular gene as such, but turning on and off of those genes can be changed through that engagement with environmental factors. So that's how the kind of, it's nature via nurture, very much so. So you're susceptible, and then how you're raised or how you interact with your environment will then express those genes.
Yeah, that makes sense. From what I found when reading about this, attachment styles could play a role in why we get attached to physical items. Can you initially explain a bit about attachment theory and what it means in our lives?
I can. Attachment theory is one of my kind of pets. It was proposed by John Bowlby. He was an English psychologist, psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst. He was a pretty, pretty amazing guy.
That's just greedy. Pick one,
isn't it? Pick one. You know, pick one. And he was working in the field up until the 1990s. So he was He was an incredible guy. He witnessed this distress and anxiety experienced by babies when they were separated from their primary caregiver. And he then spent his life studying the long-term impact of early separation on a child's not physical, psychological well-being. And this was a time, we need to remember, this was a time when children who were ill were taken from their parents, placed in hospital with no visitors allowed or comfort given by nurses at all. Yeah. And if a child was distraught, they were left to cry it out. And the babies and young kids could be in the hospital for like months on end without any contact from their family and no physical touch, you know, except for the administration of medicines and the like. And it really was emotional and physical neglect at that stage.
Yeah.
And he also researched the effect of children being removed from parents to the country for safety during the Blitz. So he had this perfect kind of, natural experimental design that he could
use. Without having to take some babies and remove them for the sake of the experiment.
So lucky that, I mean, it's not lucky, but it's lucky in a way, you know. And, well, we're lucky that he wanted to understand that. Because if he hadn't have wanted to understand that, we could have wasted that opportunity. But it's not a, not a, it's not something we could ever do now. Because ethics would no. But he believed that humans evolved with this biological instinct to form strong, enduring bonds with their primary caregivers. So from birth, we are the center of our primary caregivers' emotional universe. They tend to all of our needs and they help us manage our emotions, provide nourishment, stimulation, and comfort. So that was his initial kind of like, we need to know that there's these strong, enduring bonds. Now, his research was extended by Mary Ainsworth. She was a developmental psychologist. She extended Bowlby's research by developing the strange situation experiments, which then formed our understanding of the types of attachments that people can express. She was another amazing scholar. She began her undergraduate studies at the age of 16 at Toronto University. Unreal. And one of the things she did her PhD, she did her master's and then PhD like so quickly, so young, amazing woman. One of the things she did was observe mother-infant interactions when she did a visit to Uganda. And this kind of formed the basis of her research. I really encourage you to have a read up on her career because her findings have had such a big impact on attachment theory. She did this stranger situation where she'd have children come into a room with some toys and there'd be this, you know, someone that this little child had never met. They were usually around about 18 months old. The child would then be left. Mum would say, see you later, step out for a period of time, and then they would observe what that child did. And there was these quite distinct sort of behaviours that that came about. And they found that secure attachment was evident when, you know, when kids would initially be a little upset. If they were secure attached, they'd usually be a little bit, oh, where's mum gone? What's happening? And then the person would kind of say, oh, yeah, have a play with some toys. And the kid would settle in. And then when mum came back, run and hug mum. This is fabulous. You know, great, mum's back. But then there was some, that was a secure attachment. So that was, you know, in times of threat or need, the child was able to seek out the caregiver for comfort and security and was kind of like a safe haven for them and acting as like a secure base to explore and gain new skills. And they were beginning to understand that they were, that they exist as separate from their caregiver. So at that 18-month stage, they're kind of a little bit of independence. And the secure ones, yeah, they got a little bit upset, but when the mother returned, happy reunion. But there are these other three types of attachment that Mary decided she would call insecure attachment. And one of those is if we experience unreliable or inconsistent interactions with our attachment figure, which is usually our mother, even to this day, one may exhibit anxious attachment. So you'd identify that by clingy or controlling or proximity-seeking behaviours. So that child in a stranger situation would scream and cry the entire time, probably not take any notice of toys, would be at the door, you know, waiting for mum to come. The next type would be a child who had repeated rejection or punishment by their attachment figures. And that would lead to this avoidant attachment. And this is like a deactivation of the attachment system, evidenced by a defensive behaviour and a denial of need for close relationships or support. So this kid, the mum would leave, the kid would take no notice, go and play with the toys, mum would return, and child would take no notice of mum. In fact, would turn away perhaps from mum and just pretend like, you're back? Whatever. So that's your avoidant kind of, I can look after myself. I know that I don't need anyone type of individual. There's a third type of insecure attachment, which is known as disorganized. Now, this is often, you know, this often occurs in homes where there's like domestic violence, postpartum depression, perhaps drug and alcohol misuse or poverty. Mental illness is a big one. Anything that leads primary caregivers to be erratic and unpredictable in their care.
Yeah.
So these kids would be maybe a bit dazed or confused or sort of erratically. They might one minute be clingy and then next minute be avoidant, and they can actually be fearful of their caregiver because they're not really not sure. Mum might change with the wind, so I need to be prepared. And I think this attachment to our primary caregivers, we don't necessarily realise the extent that how we were mothered impacts our lives until we reflect on our upbringing. Even when we compare it with others, I guess, you know, you have chats with people and you kind of go, oh, wow, oh, you had a completely different life to me.
It's kind of when you start having sleepovers at friends' houses, I think, is a big like, oh, that's interesting.
That happens. Oh,
and then
okay,
again, when you leave home, I think, and maybe live, you know, if you house share, something like that, I think you then start to go, oh, not everybody does that. Or
exactly. And it can be quite it can be quite destabilizing if you kind of haven't thought about it before. But you know, far from being under our control, the way, you know, our primary caregiver responded to our needs from the moment we were born, you know, it impacts how we treat those closest to us now. And our relationship with our primary caregiver is like a template, and we use that for all future relationships, romantic, familial. We just kind of use that template and stick it on top, and we go, well, that's how people behave together. But, you know, attachment insecurity, although it doesn't cause psychopathology, it has been linked empirically with various forms, generally related to like negative thoughts about your self-worth, shame, unstable identity, which reflects back on what we were talking about before. And it's not sufficient to cause mental illness, but what it does do is significantly reduce a person's available psychological resources in challenging circumstances. And if we grew up in a home where someone who hoards, like this is, I believe, analogous to an attachment trauma, and it could lead to disorganized attachment, definitely. I think that would be highly likely if you grew up in a significantly hoarded home yourself.
Yeah. So when something goes wrong, you don't have the reserves that another person might have to be resilient in that situation necessarily.
Exactly. And you kind of go, right, now I'm on my own. How did I deal with that before? Well, there was either someone there to take the pain away immediately, or there was no one there to take the pain away, or there was someone who was sometimes there and sometimes not there. Exactly.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The listener voicemail segment has a monthly theme to help you think of something to say. So for July, the question to answer is, what is a lesson you've learned recently? Maybe you've learnt that avoiding certain shops helps you to keep your acquiring under control, or that the world doesn't end if you run out of something you thought you needed. This is your opportunity to share your learnings with us. Have your say with your voice. If you want to record a voice message to me to potentially play on a future podcast episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave a message. The topic for July is a lesson you've learnt recently. Let us know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail. So what do attachment styles have to do with both emotion regulation and possessions?
Yeah, all types of insecure attachment will negatively impact our ability to manage our emotions. So if we're not attended to appropriately and kind of taught to self-soothe in our early years, birth to 2 years, our ability to express and manage our emotional landscape will be impaired significantly. We kind of look to that primary caregiver and our relationship with them as that template, as I said before. And if we haven't been attended to properly, maybe we've had an over-involved caregiver who kind of helicopters around us and puts us in a padded suit to go to the playground and kind of fixes everything for us, then we're unprepared to kind of manage any strong emotions when we mature. Or we might have had an under-involved caregiver who kind of ignores us, pays no attention to our emotions and neglects our needs. So,
or confusingly different ones on different days.
Exactly. And you're going, hang on, this, the rules were this yesterday and now the rules are different today. And how come I thought I was really focused? I thought I knew what was going on, but now I don't. And that leads to all sorts of, people-pleasing behaviours and all sorts of kind of masking of your emotions. Yeah, we do. We just get confused. And we're constantly vigilant, paying extremely close attention to what the emotions, you know, what other people's emotions are, and even helping them manage their emotions. You know, it's okay. You know, I'm sorry I asked you that. I'll help. I'll fix it. Whatever. And then we push our own emotions down through the use of coping mechanisms in order to just avoid any of those internal kind of experiences. So if we haven't got that person to go to, we're either, we've got someone who smothers us, or we've got someone who ignores us, or we've got that kind of inconsistent person, we might use something like a toy or a teddy bear or a blanket or things in our room to kind of manage our emotions when we feel shame or rejection. And that could eventually, I mean, my hypothesis is it might end up in this excessive attachment to our belongings, particularly when we love sort of cute, cuddly things or, you know, sweet things, I really do feel that there's that necessity, you know, that there's this link back to a childhood of maybe missing out on some of that. And then avoidant attachment might encourage people to use possessions to express, like to gain power over others or impress people or make connections or feel self-confident. So it depends on what type of insecurity you have, but that's our way of managing ourselves when we haven't learnt how to do that in our early relationships.
There's a tweet I see periodically that says something like, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but you're not an empath. You just grew up in a home where in order to survive, you had to constantly be aware of the minute by minute emotions of the people around you.
Exactly. And you take that with you. You end up moving into relationships that are the same because you feel comfortable. I know what to expect. I know that I can handle it because I've handled it before. What you can't handle is when someone's a caring, supportive individual and you're going, hang on a minute.
What do I do with this?
What do I do with this? You're telling me you just want to listen to me? Do you mean that seems crazy? You're not going to give me your opinion and you're not going to, you know, burst out crying? What?
And they will do the same tomorrow and the day after and the day after that. What's going on there?
And they will always be there. They will always be there and they will always be happy to listen without judgment. And you're like, wow.
Yeah.
This planet, is this the right planet? Yeah, it's a very interesting kind of concept, and it's worth thinking through how you were parented, because it's not their fault, but it's a reality that will be impacting how you relate to other people, whether they be romantic relationships or whether it's other family members, for the rest of your life.
Or indeed your stuff.
Yeah, or indeed your stuff.
So in one of your weekly emails, which I always recommend people subscribe to, and this kind of insight is why. So in one of your weekly emails, you said, we are using our belongings to forge connections and regulate our emotions because our stuff is less frustrating or disappointing and more reliable than the people in our lives. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so there was this experimental research done that showed people demonstrated an increase in attachment to inanimate objects when those that were close to them seemed unreliable. So they did this little experiment where they made the person feel like, you know, their partner or their mother or whatever was unreliable. And they then increase their attachment to inanimate objects. And my early research into hoarding, loneliness, and adult attachment found that, like, the insecurely attached and lonely were more likely to report hoarding behaviours. So further, I found that those with insecure adult relationship attachments were more lonely and believed objects represented their identity and their connections to the world. And we're more likely to hoard possessions. So that's kind of at the evidence there that we use our belongings at way to forge connections, and we're connecting possibly with our past, other people's past, our history. Sometimes we use our possessions as a way to reconnect with people. I found this thing that I want to give to someone that I love, but I don't have any other I don't have an excuse, so I'll find something that will bring us together. So that gift giving sort of obsession that we often have as hoarders. And that our stuff doesn't argue, it doesn't disappoint us, it's there, you know, it's always there.
My books will never leave me.
They will never leave you, and they're never going to kick up a fuss if you, you know, if you do something that they don't like.
If you come home drunk or...
Exactly. If you come home drunk or, you know, you don't put the toilet seat down, they're not going to get angry with you. But humans are unfortunately...
Human.
Not human and not reliable at all in most instances. Yeah, so that's where our the kind of compensatory the compensatory sort of theory of hoarding and possessions is that they're replacing this attachment that we that we're missing from our relationships. But we've found in the research that our possessions aren't really very good at being human substitutes. Like, they're not really the best because they're not, you know, they don't interact quite as well as a human. But we are wired for a connection. So that might be why we, you know, we do anthropomorphize them. We do, you know, give our cars names and we do sit and talk with our stuffed toy that we had from a child. We just can't help seeking belonging, even if it's from a stuffed toy. We just, that's just how we're wired.
And could there be something about, I love this teddy bear. It's never going to leave me. It doesn't challenge me. It's not quite enough, but maybe three teddy bears will be. And then it's good and it fulfills it, but it's not quite enough. So maybe I need 10.
Yes. Yes, I do think yes, more is better. Like, oh, surely more will make everything go away. And then after you've got 50, you go, oh, didn't really work, did it? Now how do I get rid of 50?
Yeah, because they're all my friends and they're all
my friends. Yeah. They really are. And I remember when I bought them, and I remember, you know, how I felt when I bought them. And I couldn't possibly let them go because then I would be abandoning them like I was abandoned or like, you know.
So what is a transitional object and what is transitional object attachment?
Ah, so this is a theory that was developed by Winnicott, who was a contemporary of Bowlby in the early to mid 20th century. And he described a transitional object as that first treasured possession that a child finds soothing and comforting and has been considered to kind of stand for the primary caregiver, and which most cases this is the child's mum. Now, for my children, both of my boys, the thing that became that transitional object was the muslin that they were wrapped in.
Yeah.
Every time they were fed, every time they were put to bed, it was the muslin they were wrapped in. So that became that treasured object because it kind of stood in for me when I wasn't in the room. It probably kind of smelt a little bit like me and it was kind of soft and mum's kind of soft. So they made that kind of connection. Now, it's not a replacement for the mother. The idea is that it's an intermediary between, you know, the internal and external reality for the infant, that it's like a path or a step towards independence from the mother. So that's why it works when you drop your child off at childcare, for example, that they've got that special object.
Have you got your teddy?
Have you got your teddy? Have you got your cat? Have you got your blankie?
Yeah.
And they will be able to have a nap and know that they've got those two objects. And it is really, okay, I'm away from mum, but I know that I can use that to kind of self-soothe and connect and relax.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I had Pilly. I lost Pilly in a hotel room and Pilly was never to be seen again. So that was a bit of a shame. But, you know, both my boys still have their blankies, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe. I won't ask them. They'll be embarrassed. A bit too old now for me to go, where's blankie?
When they're going out on a date.
No, don't forget blankie. Oh, my goodness. But transitional object attachment is related. So learning theory kind of suggests that the physical similarities between that soft object and mother kind of leads it to become, this is word salad, but a discriminant stimulus and conditioned reinforcer. So it's kind of like a learning, so kind of Pavlovian kind of, you know, conditioning. But what I thought, there was some really interesting research done in the early 2000s where they were trying to work out whether the soft object, the blankie or whatever, was a compensation for unmet attachment needs. And they were trying to investigate whether the security of the attachment to the mother was related to that transitional object attachment to a blanket, and how the kids use that object in novel situations. So sort of stranger situation again. But they found that the actual attachment to the object and the attachment to the mother developed independently, which makes sense. So it wasn't a substitute. Again, they actually did find that it was that transition. It was a transitional object. Yeah. But they did find that insecurely and securely attached toddlers use them in different ways.
Oh, interesting.
So insecure toddlers who had this attachment to a blanket would use the blanket instead of seeking out their mum in novel environments. So it offered some comfort to the insecurely attached. So it was like a symbol of the union, but the securely attached kids didn't need it. You know, they didn't use it because they didn't have that anxiety around it. You know, I guess it was possible that they weren't sure that they were going to receive the appropriate comfort or reassurance, so they didn't want to be rejected or invalidated or whatever. So they're like, I'll just use that blanket. It's a safe option. And, you know, maybe more reliable and consistent, as we've just hypothesized. I'm not sure. That's the inference the researchers were kind of making. But, yeah, it did not impact the securely attached toddlers. And they sought out their mums regardless of whether they had that attachment or not to that object. So they were much more confident and secure and happy in that relationship, which makes complete sense. But I did think it was quite an interesting observation.
So I was really interested to read that transitional objects are not a universal phenomenon. They're very much a Western thing. What significance does that have?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on parenting, but I think typically like Western child rearing involves, you know, we separate from our child immediately after birth, don't we? We kind of go, we sleep in a separate, yeah. Sometimes we have the baby in the room. Often we put the baby in a different room to sleep from day one, you know, and we're kind of keen to raise these independent individuals who can manage their emotions in all situations and not look, you know, you've got to be self-reliant. And so there's that, requirement for the child to individuate versus fitting in and conforming, which happens in more collectivist cultures like, you know, in Japan, parts of Asia, that sort of thing. So I think it's that. I think really it's that. You know, you need to be able to be independent, and children aren't really capable of that, to be quite fair. You know, they're just not developed to that point. So there's this need for this transitional object to assist them in that. But I don't know enough about the comparisons, but I do know that it was only really found in Western cultures or in Westernized cultures. And I do think it is that we want them to be individual from word go.
Yeah. So like, I don't want to get them to sleep. Otherwise, the phrase is always, I'm creating a rod for my own back. That's always the phrase. If they rely on me to rock them to sleep, they will never get to sleep themselves. So from day one, I'm putting them down and their job is to self-soothe and get themselves to sleep. That's a lot to ask of a new baby.
I agree. They're so tiny. You just think, oh, how can I just let you cry? I couldn't do it. I could not do it. It was heartbreaking. And, you know, when you're a mum, that sound of the baby crying is visceral. It just makes your heart kind of clench and you feel physically ill. And I had a crier. The first one was a screamer. And when he would scream, my whole body would just be, you know, a bundle of nerves. So picking him up and cuddling him, if it worked, if it stopped him crying, well, then we were both, you know, we were both calm and relaxed. So it made sense. But yes, that, oh, if I don't get them to self-soothe and sleep on their own, then I'll never get them to do that, which I don't agree, but I think it is a very Western Dr. Spock kind of, you know, yes, throwback from that era too, you know.
We had Dr. Spock's book in our house, and I read some of it. I was a strange child, and I remember the bit of advice I remember from it was, in order to get your child to eat vegetables, what you do is you serve dessert first and say, if you're good and eat all of your dessert, you can have some broccoli. And that way to get your child excited about food. And I expect that works in one child in 1,000.
I just called broccoli trees and that worked. And I called Brussels sprouts tiny cabbages. That worked. They both, well, I lie. One of them doesn't eat them. The other one loves them.
Brussels sprouts are horrible. Oh, I'm on the side of the one who doesn't eat them. I know someone
love
who,
them.
Until their kid started school, they'd managed to convince him that raisins were sweets.
Oh.
So if you could, you can have some sweets. And he would be like, oh, and they'd give him raisins. And he thought that was the best thing. And then he started school and his friends were like, they're not sweets. That's fruit.
Oh, God. Ah, the things we do to our children. There was some research around, like, the fit between, this was done in a Western sample. So mums who saw themselves as more kind of traditional, strict or controlling were more likely to have those strong children with strong object attachments. So I'm guessing, you know, there's more demands on that child to sit over there quietly, you know, here's your dummy, here's your blankie, whatever. And inflexible mums were more likely to kind of encourage that object attachment, which makes sense again, you know. You know, they make sure that they're relying less on their mother for that emotional support and regulation. And they use their, like you were saying before, use it as a stress management tool. So that's my tool. And when I get it, then I immediately calm down.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting too, which mirrors what I've observed.
And I think it's important to say that what we're talking about is not that phenomenon where everything is the mother's fault. It's not that thing where whatever somebody does, somebody will say, I blame the mother. What it is, and correct me if this is wrong, but what it is, it's about the most significant early attachment. And in most cases, that just is the mother.
Exactly. And that is exactly it. The other thing that Winnicott was well known for was the good enough mother theory. So his theory was, it's what, you know, being there, we all make mistakes. We don't have to be perfect. That is never the aim of parenting. But if you're there and you're good enough, which means you're not doing anything negative, harmful, then this is going to be, you know, that's what the child needs. It just needs you there. And you will make mistakes. My goodness. We all make mistakes in all areas of our lives. And I think the most important thing to learn is how to repair, how to come back from that, how to admit you were wrong, even to your children. I mean, parents in my day would never say they were wrong. Never. They would back themselves to the ends of the earth. And I say quite often, I made a mistake.
I love that my friends who are kids will do that and say, I'm sorry I shouted, I panicked, or I was really angry, but I understand it's really upsetting for you and I'm sorry about that. And it, every time I witness that, it blows my mind, because as you say, you know, my parents' generation, your parents' generation, that was not part of the way things worked.
No, they were right. And they, you know, and they would back it. They would back it. They went, no, that's not happening. And I've done it numerous times where I've kind of said no to something and then I've gone away and thought about it. Or I've said yes to something and I've gone away and thought about it. And I've said, you know what, for these reasons, I've decided to change my mind and knows the answer. And, you know, they've always taken it very well. You know, they might get a bit cranky initially and then they'll say, you know what, I thought about it and you were right. I'm glad I didn't, you know, do that.
I kind of think if parents are modelling this is how you say sorry and admit that you made a mistake or broke something, then surely the kid is then also freer to say sorry, Mum, rather than dig their heels in when something goes wrong for them.
Yeah, or deny that they ever did anything wrong and then, you know, and then you lack transparency in the relationship and everything just becomes, you know, transactional when you deal with your parent. It's not what we want. We want them to come to us when they do need something. We don't want them to go outside of our relationship to find, you know, answers.
Yeah.
When we're the ones that can give them a considered answer.
So stepping outside of kind of deep psychology for a minute, we also can't ignore that we live in a world that is constantly screaming to us about how much better our life will be if we just buy this, that, and the other. Is there any evidence that people who hoard are more susceptible to this kind of messaging?
This is actually something I wanted to get your opinion on too. Do you think that's the case? Like, do you think that, you know, you're more susceptible to messaging or about the same as everybody else?
I wonder whether we might see that messaging as kind of permission for something we already want to do.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Like, I don't know for sure, but I think, you know, sometimes you need someone's, one of my friends said, I'm great to go charity shopping with because whenever she picks something up, I'm always like, oh, you've got to get that. And I'm just like, I'm her permission from start to finish to buy everything she likes. And sometimes we do look for permission for something that we definitely want. And I wonder whether we then use marketing or influencers or whatever as that permission.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little around this topic. There's quite a bit around attachment style and consumer behavior. There's quite a bit around that, which is quite interesting. But I think these messages that grab us and tell us we'll be better, you know, if we buy some shiny doodad, I think it leads all of us to be irresponsible consumers in general. And the majority of us are kind of careless with our possessions and we cast them aside, you know, we cast aside that old thing, which probably isn't old to most people, for some shiny new model. And I think often the abhorrence of waste and the concern, you know, that environmental protectionism kind of perfectionism and protectionism rises up in hoarders and they want to save everything because some horrible person threw it out.
Yeah.
So it's kind of in a roundabout way, you know, everybody is susceptible to those messages, but some of us are just able to let go real easy because something new's come into our lives. Whereas, you know, the shame and the guilt around being irresponsible consumers kind of, you know, eats you up more than it probably eats up others.
Yeah, because it's undeniable that our generation buys multiples more than our grandparents' generation bought. Oh. And in order for that to be livable, things need to be going out as well as coming in. And if they're not, that's when it literally piles up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if we, you know, it happens quite often. I see it happening where one person will say, oh, I've just got this new thing, I'm just going to get rid of that. And the other person will go, what? Really? You can't, you only just got that. You can't possibly. And then, oh, I'll have it. And I think to myself, this is a systemic problem. This is a system that is, you know, everything is geared to, you know, all the money is spent on getting us to consume more and more and more. And how can we be attempting to make consumption sustainable when they're using their best minds to trick us into buying everything under the sun?
I remember years ago I needed a printer. And I know, they are the worst inventions in the world. But anyway, so I went to, this was the old days, so I went to a shop and I was looking at the various printers, and there was this, I only needed something really basic, and the most like basic printer cost, it was like £30 or something, which is about $50. And the sales guy came over and he said, the good thing about, he could see that I was looking at the cheapest one. He said, the good thing about that one is that it's cheaper to buy that printer that has ink included than it is to buy ink refills. So it's basically like a disposable printer. So when you run out of ink, you just buy a new one rather than buying refills, which cost more than the refills. And it blew my mind that that was built in. That was the way it was meant to be.
And it continues on to this day, because I was only looking at them the other day to reconfirm to myself that it was a scam.
Yeah.
And there they were sitting there so cheap.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how can we be doing this still? This has been going on. Printers are so, they're incredibly infuriating.
They just don't work. How has nobody invented a printer that speaks to the computer properly yet?
Oh, tell me about it. Mine's kicked up a fuss now too, and I'm thinking about replacing it. I'm going, I have to get rid of that now, and no one's going to buy it from me. I mean, I have to pay someone to take it away. It's incredibly frustrating. And the number of printers I see in homes, you know, like more than one, because people have seen them on the side of the road and someone's put a big sticker on it saying still works. And they're like, and then they haven't found out that it cost them $80 for the cartridge. So it just sits there, you know, for months on end. But we're making it more difficult for ourselves and for everyone else. As a society, it's crazy.
And when you visualize the landfill that all this stuff ends up in, it's the vastness. I know there's not one landfill in the world. I know they're all going to one place. But even just your average city's dump, or whatever it's called in different countries, and that's just one city in the entire world. And that's not to say we shouldn't throw things away.
No.
But it is to say we need to be careful about what we acquire in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, the letting go of the things that are in the home right now, I mean, they've already been produced. They're already waste. They've already been paid for. You know, they no longer have that value. But we really need to be much more vigilant about what we bring in, because we know once it comes into our homes, regardless of whether, you know, you would identify yourself as a hoarder or not, it is so hard to get that object out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's getting harder every day. It's getting harder to donate. It's getting harder to recycle. And I just feel like we need to just double check ourselves when we go and get looking for that little dopamine hit. Is there something else I could do that would, you know, could I call a friend, or could I, you know, instead of buying that lipstick, you know, because that used to be my thing. I'll go and get some nail polish or some lipstick or whatever, you know, that's a cheap, and, you know, ended up with 100 bottles of nail polish and 100 lipsticks that I never use.
And they dry up and then,
So it was like, oh, I just need a little pick me up.
Yeah.
I would have been better off ringing a friend, or, you know, or going for a walk or doing something else, you know. Yeah.
And it feels important to point out that a lot of people who do not have a problem exclusively with stuff, it's not like it's stuff or necessarily. Mm. A lot of us have other maladaptive coping mechanisms alongside it. I self-harmed for a long time. Others may have substance use disorder, or, you know, even push themselves too hard at work, or unhealthy relationships. It's not like it's one or the other, because we're complex beings, right?
Oh, exactly. And many of us struggle. Many of us have things that we use that we believe are acceptable as well.
Yes.
You know, like the over-exercising and the glass of wine
at the end of the day.
Exactly. A glass of wine every day, or whatever it might be. We kind of classify things as being appropriate ways of coping and inappropriate, or maladaptive and adaptive. But the thing about stuff is that up to a point, it's acceptable, right? Up to a point, we feel like it's acceptable. Then once it gets to a certain tipping point, then we feel like we're being judged and it's too much. And that's the hardest part about it, because I tell you what, there are many, 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 many people out there who are on the border, you know, who are teetering on that tipping point, and they may be feeling self-righteous. I would never go, you know, that would never happen to me. And I can tell you right now, you know, you get some sort of an injury, you have a loss where you're grieving, maybe, you know, lose a job. Those little things happen and you tip over the edge, and then you look around and say, how did I get here? And I have to remind people, this is not who you are. This is your circumstance. This is something that we need to work on. It's not the end. It's not the end of your life as you know it. It's something we need to work on. And that's really hard, because people want the shame they feel, they want to just shut down and go, well, this is, you know, this is obvious. It's obvious that I'm this terrible person for the way I'm living. It's like, seriously? Those things that happened just tipped you over.
It's like people say you're only ever 3 paychecks away from homelessness or something. It's the same thing. If you have a tendency towards something and then somebody dies, or you get long COVID, or you lose your job, or anything, that could be, it's the tipping point, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is, totally. And that whole idea of, you know, you're only 3 paychecks away, you know, you're only one decision away from having a crappy life, and you're only one decision away from having an amazing life. It's like, you know, either way, we're just, you know, we're all in that space, really, in one way or another, with most things in our lives.
And this may be a PhD of its own, but I wonder whether there's something, because I know from listeners, I'm not the only person with a history of self-harm. And the thing about self-harm and about hoarding is that it's kind of somebody feeling a lot of distress and then externalizing it, making it something, whether that's on the outside of your body or on the around you, And it's not necessarily about people seeing an expression of your distress, because quite often with both self-harm and hoarding, it's well hidden. So it's not about expressing it externally for people to see, but there is something about, I can't cope with this inside me. Let's make the chaos on the outside.
Outside. Yeah, it's very interesting. I don't know. That's kind of an interesting concept, because I do find that most that I come in contact with are very, that they are externalizers, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of their go-to.
Yeah.
And I can see how that, you know, and as you say, there is some, you know, overlap with self-harm, you know, with other sorts of body dysmorphias, all those kinds of things. And I think, well, yeah, they're all kind of external, aren't they? There is some way of controlling what's happening inside, because you feel you can't handle it inside. But if it's outside, I can do something about it. I can manage it somehow.
Yeah. Mm. And also back to that thing about tipping point. When I worked with young people who self-harmed, they almost without exception also had some degree of eating disorder. And what would happen would be one of them would be reasonably under control while the other one was out of control. And then, so they would be self-harming very severely, but eating. And then they would manage to reduce their self-harming behaviors, but then couldn't eat. And so I'm thinking also, if you are drinking and almost hoarding, and then you start to get your drinking a bit under control, that could also be a tipping point, couldn't it?
Yeah, because you haven't found that adaptive coping mechanism. You're just constantly juggling the maladaptive one to another, you know. And I see that quite often. I do see that quite often. And it's something. It's about coming to terms with that there needs to be something else. There needs to be some other coping mechanism that you can. You know, you can bring in to part those two things that are just one-upping, you know, up. It's just like a seesaw, man. It's, you know, it's really hard. And it's not great for your health, of course. I mean, all of these things are just very, you know, and that can then impact on your energy levels, how well you're able to deal with all sorts of things in all areas of your life.
I read a study the other day. They looked at older people who hoarded compared to older people who did not hoard, and how much more disabled in a multitude of ways the people who hoarded were.
The functional impact of hoarding on a person, you know, how disabled they are. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
And that's often, it gets to that point, it gets beyond that tipping point, and then, you know, you look for help. And I just would love people to seek out help if they can, kind of before they get to that point, because and I know that it's so shaming to invite someone into your home, but really, like, we've seen it all, and we understand the underlying, you know, in ways that this can impact your life. So that means we sort of are really ready to help if you're ready to accept help. But I know it's really hard. I know it's hard. And I just commend, tell everybody who contacts me, you know, you've done so well making contact with me. This is such a difficult thing to admit.
Love that. Jan, thank you so much. Your insight is so valuable, and yeah, you're fab. Jan, if people want to find you online, where can they do so?
So if you want to check me out on Instagram and Twitter, you can contact me on @stuff_ology or Facebook, Stuffology Consulting, or you can shoot me an email, jan@stuffology.com.au. But come on over to the website and sign up for the newsletter. I send that out. I don't use snail mail. send that out.
That would be a disaster given your audience.
Giving my audience paper? No. No. So, no, it is not a mail out ye olde style. It is your modern email newsletter once a week, Sunday afternoons.
Amazing.
So take care.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Do you want to be a de-hoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. So my top tip this week is a clip from the ADHD for Smart Ass Women podcast. And host Tracy Otsuka is asking Casey Davis, who you may remember as a previous guest on this show, what her best advice for people with ADHD is. And this is great advice if you've got ADHD. And it's also pretty good advice, or a lot of it, if you don't. Have a listen.
So what do you think the key to living successfully with ADHD is?
I definitely think, really, same approach that I think with care tasks. I think having a strong foundation of moral neutrality, you know, your neurotype is not a moral failing. It's just the way that you are. And I think having a self-compassionate inner dialogue around the way that you are, and knowing that it's okay and that you might need to do things differently, being willing to embrace adaptive imperfection, being willing to embrace adaptive routines, being willing whenever it's possible to say, you know, the way that I am is legitimate and it's okay for me to change my environment to meet my needs. And there will be times or environments that you can't change. And that's when you try to develop new skills or you ask for accommodations. And at the end of the day, your neurotype is morally neutral.
So think about how that can apply in your life. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast. Where can they do so?
You can...
Brilliant, thanks ever so much.
Okay, right, let's go.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critics pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
These days, having versatile clothing you can wear anywhere is a must. That's why American Giant makes all sorts of versatile any-weather staples, hoodies, jackets, and more. Whether you're buying a gift or stocking your closet, you'll find just what you need, and it's all made right here in the USA. Find your new wardrobe staples at American-Giant.com and get 20% off your order when you use code ANYSTYLE24 at checkout. That's 20% off at American-Giant.com, promo code ANYSTYLE24.